IllbeHonest.com.
Galatians chapter 5. We'll read the first 12 verses. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. And I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. You've been severed from Christ. You are seeking to be justified by law. You've fallen from grace. For we, through the Spirit, by faith, are waiting for the hope of righteousness. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything, but faith working through love. You were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion did not come from him who calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. I have confidence in you, in the Lord, that you will adopt no other view. And the one who is disturbing you will bear his judgment, whoever he is. But I, brethren, if I still preach circumcision, why am I still persecuted? Then the stumbling block of the cross has been abolished. I wish that those who were troubling you would even mutilate themselves. It's not my intent this morning to exposit these 12 verses, but rather to use them as a backdrop for two verses that I'd like to highlight this morning, found in the middle of the chapter, verse 7 and verse 8. You were running well, who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion is not from him who calls you. I'd like to talk to you today generally on the topic of hindering persuasions. Hindering persuasions. You know, many start out fair, run well for a while, are hindered, give up, quit, meet obstacles, stop. And the Christian life oftentimes in the Bible is used as in the illustration of a runner running a race, right? Several different places, running a race. The Apostle Paul says, who hindered you? You were running well. What happened? You know, I was made aware of a situation in a marathon in Carolina. A man was entered in the half marathon event. It's 13.1 miles, but it was run in conjunction with a marathon, 26.2 miles. And oftentimes in those major races like that, the two groups start at the same time, a simultaneous start. And then somewhere along the course, the half marathoners were to break off and head downtown to their finish line, and the marathoners were to continue on for the full 26.2 miles. This man found himself leading the entire race, and he arrived at an intersection where one of the race officials directed him with a flag to follow the lead escort vehicle, which naturally he did. And 2 miles further down the road, he discovered that he had missed the turn for the half marathoners, and he was now 2 miles on further onto the course along with the marathoners. It was a hindering persuasion, so to speak. And what did he do? He couldn't go back. He decided to continue on, finish the full marathon, which he won. But he was disqualified, citing an old USA track and field law that states you can't win a race you're not entered in. Now, that served to illustrate my point. He was running well, better than anyone in the whole field. But he was hindered. he took a wrong turn, persuaded, as it would be. And so we've got the Apostle Paul here writing to the Galatians. He says, you were running well. What happened? Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion is not from him who calls you. And so I say that is the topic this morning. They were retarded in their Christian course. And it's implied that it was by someone. They listened to someone they ought not ever to have listened to. In other words, they had every indication they should have continued on running well, except they listened to someone and were hindered in it. He says, who hindered you? That is someone they should not have listened to. Now this Greek word, I don't know a lot of Greek, but I've got a computer program and it explains it for me. And this Greek word that is translated hinder in our in this translation of mine, the NAS, literally means hinder by breaking up the road. Now we could discover there may be two ways that could apply. You know, if a military is advancing forward, a tactic of the enemy, of the other military, is to break the road up ahead of them, to hinder their progress. You see, it illustrates well, doesn't it? But in the context of this idea of running a race, who hindered you, it also applies in the sense that you could be competing as a runner in a race and someone cuts in ahead of you, someone takes up your lane, they break up your line, and you're hindered. Now, we have an enemy that is very willing to do that, don't we? And we could say for sure, you that are true Christians, you know that the day you made a move toward God, forces were set in action to hinder you. And when you became a Christian, they were stepped up to hinder you even more. Now, I don't know a lot about the demonic realm and spiritual oppression and those kinds of things. Our brethren here that are visiting along with us have far more knowledge in an intimate way than that, but I say you as well as me, everyone in this room, knows more about this subject maybe than you realize. Because every Christian is hindered by the enemy. So the apostle tells them that by hearkening to these hindering persuasions, the end result was they didn't obey the truth. They were turned out of the way. The truth, it's always under attack, isn't it? Always, at every turn, the truth is under attack. Turn back two chapters to chapter 3 of Galatians. Verse 1. You foolish Galatians. That's strong language there. You foolish Galatians. Who has bewitched you? The King James Version reads, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth? There it is again. Turned away from following the truth. And this word bewitched, it literally means to fascinate by false representations. A technique of the enemy again. A false representation before long, you're being hindered from obeying the truth, turned out of the way. That's what I'm talking about. Hindering persuasions. A lie is present and a person is led astray from the truth to embrace something that's not a reality. That's what the enemy's intent on doing. And he says in verse 8 of our text in chapter 5, he says, this persuasion did not come from him who calls you. In other words, it come from Satan and his instruments. Could be knowing to no other than that. By means of a lie, they're thrown from their faith and obstructed in the progress of the gospel. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 2, he says, that you be not quickly shaken from your composure or disturbed, either by a spirit or a message or a letter, as if from us, in other words, it's fake, to the effect that the day of the Lord has already come. There's the lie. And what does it do? It shakes them from their composure. I like that phrase. Have you ever felt shaken from your composure? And it disturbs them, and it came from a spirit. So that's what I'm talking about, hindering persuasions. We're dealing right now with the problem of hindering persuasions. In verse 9, he says, a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. That is, there's more danger in this thing than you realize. It permeates, it starts small, it grows, it increases, and it's greatly affecting. You know, you've got Peter's hypocrisy earlier on in the book of Galatians. It says even Barnabas was led astray by it. It spreads. Very affecting. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 17 and 18. He says, their talk will spread like gangrene, and among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus, men who have what? They've gone astray from the truth. And what are they doing? They're saying that the resurrection has already taken place. And what's the end result? The faith of many is upset. They upset the faith of many, hindering persuasions from the enemy. Very affecting, widespread, permeating. So in the problem of hindering persuasions, they're contagious too. They're spreading. Now in our chapter 5 of Galatians there, we see also some words that the apostle used. The one who is disturbing you. And the Greek word there means stir it up, agitate. Agitate, the one who is agitating you, getting you all stirred up. That's what's happening here with this hindering persuasion. Getting stirred up. One version says, throwing you into confusion. And that's what the enemy does, by deception, throws into confusion. In my study, I realized that in World War II, the attack on the invasion on Normandy beach, the Allies had a tactic. They parachuted en masse a bunch of little dummies behind enemy lines and against the backdrop of a sky in which there's no depth perception. You can easily see how disconcerting and confusing that was to the enemy, and the Germans turned and sent troops inward. And when all of these dummies began to land, they were rigged so that explosions went off like little firecrackers, etc., and the enemy was convinced that they were being assaulted from the back. That illustrates my point. Deception causes confusion. And the enemy is perfect at doing that, causing confusion. Who is disturbing you? Verse 12, the one who is troubling you. That word troubling right there. Again, the original language, driving you out of home. That is, your peace and your safety, and turn upside down. Who's turning you upside down? Ruining your peace and safety, driving you out of your home. The one who's doing that. So you see, these words are really descriptive of the basic problem we're talking about, the problem of hindering persuasions. You know, brethren, it's difficult enough to acquire something, but sometimes it's even harder to retain it once you've gotten it. Because the force is coming against us all the time, trying to lure us off, persuading us, hindering us, troubling us, ruining our peace, stirring us up. So these hindering persuasions, well, they can hinder us from heaven, ultimately. You see that in verse 2. Paul says, behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. Christ, who can save to the uttermost, to some people is of no benefit to them. The Galatians right here, if they had received circumcision, if they began to add to the finished work of Christ, he was made of no benefit to them, hindered from heaven. That's my point. That's major. That frequently happens, but also, even just as frequently, the believer is hindered in his walk, in sanctification, in following on with God, hindered in the place of prayer. How many times have you attempted to enter into the place of prayer and you've heard that voice, "I'm not doing any good. He's not listening to me." This persuasion does not come from Him who calls you. It's a hindering persuasion. Before you know it, you give it up, you go off and mow the lawn or something like that. And He's won. You see, we all know something of these things. And it's my purpose here today just to enlighten you that you might be on guard against that. You might be aware of that. He hinders us. John Bunyan, in his book, Grace Abounding, in which he gives his testimony in a biographical, autobiographical way, at one point in his life, he was convinced by the devil that calling and election was not for him. And he was brought to the place where he was jealous of those verses in the Bible in which it stated Christ called his disciples and they left their nets and followed him, or they left the tax booth and followed him. He was jealous of that calling. And other places where it's stated, Jesus went up onto the mountain and called his disciples to him. John Bunyan's heart ached because he felt he was convinced, utterly convinced, that that wasn't for him. Now, where did that come from? It's from the enemy. And had he continued to be persuaded that way, he never would have made it. Ever. The door of mercy to him was shut. That's what I'm talking about. These hindering persuasions, they hinder us in our progress and sanctification. They hinder us in our reality, in our walk with Christ. They hinder us. They steal our joy. You know, I could be far more joyful if I believed less lies of the enemy and more promises from the Bible. I could walk and live in more peace and be less disturbed and troubled within the things that I face day to day if I believed more of the promises, and I didn't buy into so many lies of the devil slipped in there, hindering persuasions. Christian, in Pilgrim's Progress, there's a section in there in which he goes through the valley of shadow of death. It's dark. He can't see where his next step is going to fall whenever he picks his foot up to walk on. He hears screams and moans and shrieks in the darkness on either side, and it's stated there that the path was the most narrow at that place. And he went on, and it's said in John, in that account, that he was so confused in that place that he did not know his own voice. And one of the wicked ones got up behind him, stepping up so softly to him and whispering suggestions of deplorable blasphemies to him in his ear, and he actually thought they had originated in his own mind. I love the book of Pilgrim's Progress. It's so true to spirit, to real spiritual experience, Christian experience. He had a real insight into that. And so here is Christian, persuaded. He didn't even know what his own voice was. He was persuaded that those suggestions coming in from the outside were his own thoughts. That's how subtle the enemy is. That's how these hindering persuasions can get in there and stir us up. We think there are even our own thoughts. They can hinder us in the fellowship of the church and cause you to withdraw. They can hinder you in the advancement of the work of the gospel, cause you to be discouraged. Discouragement is what every pastor faces, and I know all of you face it the same. Oftentimes, that discouragement comes on the heels of believing something, some suggestion put into your mind, rather than the reality. And we're cast down in the midst of it. So we've gone over my first heading, the problem of hindering persuasions. How about now if we look at some frequent occurrences in the Bible, some examples of hindering persuasions? That would be good, wouldn't it? How about this one? 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1. You don't have to turn there. I'd be glad to read it to you. The Spirit explicitly says that in latter times, some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. There it is, plain as day. Paying attention to these things, deceitful spirits, and the end result, they fall away. Demons. The activity of Satan in 2 Thessalonians is false wonders, all the deception of wickedness, a deluding influence so that they will believe a lie. That's the enemy. Conrad Murrell, some of you know him, many of you might not. He's been a wonderful influence in my life and an influence in the lives of men that I respect. He had a very peculiar ministry among the demonically oppressed. And he wrote a book entitled Practical Demonology. It is very practical. But he quotes in that book, oddly enough, in a case where he was ministering to a young lady, a demon presented himself and said this to Brother Conrad. He said, "I accuse her because she hasn't done something. And then when she does it, I accuse her for not doing the right thing. She thinks I'm God." Hindering persuasions. The voice of the enemy, it's nothing more than a lie. And we can get so confused in these things, we begin to think they're our own thoughts, or even sometimes we begin to think they might be God. And we're hindered in the way. Colossians 2, "See to it that no one takes you captive," that is, leads you away like booty, a captive, captured. "See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy or empty deception." There it is again, empty deception. "According to the traditions of men and the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ." Hindering persuasions. How about that famous verse in 2 Corinthians 10:5? "We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing that raises itself up against the knowledge of God, and we're taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ." Thoughts. So there we've got these demons and deceitful spirits and philosophies and deceptions that way. How about these examples? The first one ever recorded in the Bible, and perhaps the greatest ever, Eve. "You shall not surely die." Where did that come from? Now, is that a hindering persuasion or what? The entire world plunged into sin and darkness as a result of that one. The best of men have been persuaded wrongly and hindered in it. Abraham in Genesis 20, "Because I thought surely there's no fear of God in this place and they will kill me because of my wife," he lied and said Sarah was his sister. And she was taken into Abimelech's harem. What a wicked persuasion, a hindering persuasion. Here's Elijah, 1 Kings chapter 19. His persuasion was this: "I alone am left and they seek my life to take it," there at the mouth of the cave. What did God say? The reality was, "I've got 7,000 men that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. What are you talking about?" A hindering persuasion. The best of men fall to that. Moses, chapter 11. Moses says, "Why have you been so hard on your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight that you've laid the burden of all this people on me? So if you're going to deal thus with me, please kill me now." What a thing. At the Jordan River, the spies came back from the promised land, the beautiful land. What did the bad spies say? "We're not able to go up against these people. They're too strong for us." They highlighted fortified cities and giants in the land. But what was the reality? Caleb stood up and said, "We should by all means go up against them. We'll surely overcome them." And he survived. All the others went back into the wilderness. The whole generation of them died, hindering persuasions. David, numbering the people, it's said there in 1 Chronicles 21, Satan moved David to number the people. The end result, the destroying angel, a pestilence. It's easy to see by these examples what the devil is doing, isn't it? The disciples in the boat, "Master, don't you care that we're perishing?" What an insult to Jesus. "Don't you care that we're perishing?" Personally, I find that we're very vulnerable to these hindering persuasions in the realm of our feelings, both good and bad. You know, Eve felt good about eating the fruit of that tree. It looked good. It would make you wise, so she took it. We're vulnerable in our feelings. And it comes out oftentimes in the Psalms. The psalmist in Psalm 73, he says this, "Surely in vain I've kept my heart pure and washed my hands in innocence." What a lie that is. It's not in vain that our heart is ever kept pure, is it? Or that we ever walk in innocence. And he went on to say, "I've been stricken all day long and chastened every morning." Job, he was persuaded, "Why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy?" But the reality, God said, "There's no one else like him." Persuaded that God was hiding from him. David in the Psalm, Psalm 13, verse 1, said, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever?" Where did that come from? The Lord said, "I'll never forget you," right? "I've inscribed you on my hands." But David was convinced that God was forgetting him, had forgotten him. "How long will you hide your face from me?" This is in the realm of our perceived feelings. We're easily persuaded and suspect. Psalm 22:1, my God, why have you forsaken me?" But he wasn't forsaken. "I'll never leave you nor forsake you." That's the reality of it. Psalm 10, verse 1, "Why do you stand afar off, O Lord? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" What does the Bible say? He's a very present help in time of trouble. You see, it's so easily we fall into the trap of being manipulated by these hindering persuasions. This persuasion did not come from him who calls you. And I just want you to be more aware of these things and more easily able to say to yourself and to the enemy, "This persuasion is not from him who calls me." The devil, he's a cunning persuader and a slanderer. Charles, in his message on the devil, your adversary, he says, "The devil slanders God to us, he slanders our brethren to us, and he slanders us to ourselves." Well, how about then, my last heading, some examinations of these persuasions. What are we to do? How do we examine these things? How are we to know that this thought in my mind, this direction that I am being persuaded to go, is false, that it's a hindrance? Well, first I'd offer this. When we're running well, that's when we ought to be the most careful. He said, "You were running well. Who hindered you?" That's the first caution. We can't get complacent in self-satisfaction and self-sufficiency. We set ourselves up. I would offer this consideration. Whatever's going through your mind right now, how does it line up with the whole Bible? Not just one verse, because the devil uses Scripture well that way. He can wield the Bible pretty good. Not one verse, but the whole Bible. How does it line up with it? I offer that for a consideration. Maybe even the first and foremost. Is it biblical? There are promises, these accounts and these examples that I've just given to you, there are promises that counteract the very things that these men of God were feeling at that time and persuaded were true. But the reality was they were false. So how does it all line up with the whole Bible? Another one, how does it line up with historical Christianity? You know, we've got a real safety net here. Not only do we have the whole Bible sitting on our laps in front of us, but we've got 2,000 years of men of God that have walked closer to Him than I ever have, that have exposited it and expounded it. And it would do us wonders to check back with historical Christianity. How is this thought represented there? How did the men of old deal with this same thing? You know, you're not the only one who's ever felt this way. So how does it line up with historical Christianity? There are things that are accepted in the church as being orthodox now that are less than 200 years old. And if something is new, some new thought, some innovative new thought in regard to the Bible, chances are you ought to run from it. It might not very well be true at all. So how does it line up with historical Christianity? 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 1 speaks about false teachers. They come in secretly introducing destructive heresies. They're very destructive, they're secret, and they're heretical. That is, they're arrived at by someone's own opinion. That's what that word means, opinion, a choice. So here some persuasion is given, and a man makes a choice, and he's diverged off from the historical orthodox representation of it. And our word heresy, translated heresy, comes from the Greek word heresis. And that word, wherever it's translated in the New Testament, oftentimes means a sect, like a sect of the Sadducees or the sect of the Pharisees. A sect. Six times it's translated that way. Two times it's translated a faction. So you see the idea that's wrapped up in a heresy like that, believing something that's new, innovative. It causes a divergence from the norm, a split, leads you off in a false direction. And so we need to be aware of those things. How does it line up with historical Christianity? Here's another one. How does it tend to make me feel? One, how does it tend to make me feel toward God if I believe this thought, if I entertain this persuasion? How does it make me feel? In 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 1 that I just read, speaking about the destructive heresies, the secret ones that are entered in there by the false teachers, it says even denying the Master. So how does it make you feel toward God? Does it make you mistrust Him? Does it make you resent Him in some way? Perhaps you're going through something right now and a thought comes into your mind and you're in the middle of a trial, a very severe trial. A thought comes into your mind, if God loved me, why is He treating me this way? Why do I have to go through this? Why am I facing this? I can't take it anymore. It's a hindering persuasion. How does it tend to make you feel toward God or toward Christ? Here are these Galatians. The persuasion that was hindering them was causing them to view Christ as insufficient, the finished work of Christ. They needed to add Judaism to it, circumcision to it, etc. Add to it the finished work of Christ. So how does it tend to make you feel? How does it tend to make you feel toward others? Not just toward God or Christ, but toward others. Does it demote the brethren in your eyes? Or something like that? How about your pastors? How does it make you feel toward your pastor? Does it make you suspicious of him? Or mistrust him in some way? And how does it make you feel inside? Does it cast you down? Does it make you discouraged? Does it steal your joy? take your peace away from you. Those kinds of things, that persuasion is not from him who calls you. How does it make you feel toward your calling or toward your work? Discouraged? Does it make you want to give it up? Does it make you feel like you're not doing any good here? How does it tend to make you react? Does it tend toward imbalance? You know, balance is a hard thing to achieve and it's a hard thing to maintain. Does this thought tend to imbalance you? The Apostle Paul told the Galatians there in verse 2 of chapter 5. No, verse 3, and I testify again to every man who receives circumcision, he's under obligation to keep the whole law. Imbalance. Imbalance. Does it imbalance you and entangle you? How about this? Does it somehow bind you? A yoke of bondage. We read in the very first verse, it was for freedom that Christ set us free. Christ is a liberator. If a thought comes into your mind and you entertain that thing and it tends to bind you, throw you in bondage in some way, this persuasion is not from him who calls you. Christ is a liberator. Satan is a binder. And a captivator. Jesus Christ, John 8:36, if the Son makes you free, you'll be free indeed. He's a liberator. Does this thought cause you to withdraw or to separate from your brethren? That can't be of God. Does it possibly cause you to promote yourself? Be proud of yourself in some way, high-minded, or elevate yourself? Can't be of God. Self-sufficiency. Does it tend to make you self-sufficient? Peter stood up and he said to Jesus, on that day, though all others forsake you, I'll never forsake you. What a thing. He was convinced he was going to die for him. The next thing you know, he's denying him three times. So those were some considerations, examinations on these thoughts. So how should we react if we determine this thought is not from him who calls me, this persuasion is not from him? How should we react? You know, in Pilgrim's Progress, in the second section, Christiana was traveling along with Mercy, and they were assaulted by two men on the way. Only two bows shot, it says, from the gate, the narrow gate. That is, you're not very far into your Christian walk before you're facing the very things I'm talking about today. Two bow shots from the gate. Demons came and assaulted them. And what was put to them were suggestions in which if they followed along with them, they would have lost all of their innocence in the way. And when she realized that that's what she was up against, her response was, "We will not hear, nor regard, nor yield." That's how we've got to approach these things. We've got to slam the door on them. When I determine that this thought is coming from the enemy, designed to disturb me, trouble me, bewitch me, all of the different things that we just talked about, I've got to slam the door on that. I can't listen to it, nor yield to it. Slam the door on it. I'd like to read a little excerpt here from a brother whom we're familiar with, I'm sure, who has a ministry in Middle Eastern country. And in his newsletter, he said this. You know, this man, a little bit of a background, he had a very disabling illness came on him in his joints, very painful, almost put to a wheelchair, my understanding on it. But he went out ministering door to door, found themselves in a home, being entertained by someone, and she noticed that he was in a lot of pain and inquired about it. And he gave a brief report to her, and she said something to the effect, "Why would God do this to you, his servant? Why would he treat his servant this way?" And this brother said this, his response was this: "After 27 years of walking with Christ, I've learned not to ask such questions, since they presuppose ideas about my Heavenly Father, which I know to be false. When we ask why, underneath the question lies misgivings about God's holy and pristine character and doubts about His power and goodness and wisdom and justice and uncertainty about His faithfulness to His promise. And we attribute to God what is completely untrue of Him. That's the very thing that I'm talking about. We can't even entertain those things because they attribute to God something that I know is not true about Him. They cast Him in a bad light. That persuasion is not from Him who calls you. But I'm very happy for the place of grace in all of this. I like in verse 10, the apostle says, I have confidence in you, in the Lord, that you will adopt no other view. The place of grace. He saves us from these kinds of persuasions. Matthew 24, 24. If possible, they would mislead even the elect. If possible. One last illustration. When Christian met the interpreter in Pilgrim's Progress, and he saw the various parables there, and they were being explained to him, he saw a fire burning next to a wall. And a man was pouring water on the fire, trying to put it out. Some of you that have read Pilgrim's Progress, you might recollect this. It's one of my favorite illustrations in that book. The man was pouring water on the fire, trying to put it out, but yet the fire was blazing all the more. And then when you go around the back side of the wall, you see there's another one on the back side pouring oil onto the fire. And it was explained to Christian by the interpreter that the fire was the work of grace in the heart of a man. And the one pouring water on it was the enemy, always trying to put it out. And behind the wall, the one pouring the oil on it was Jesus, maintaining the work of grace in the heart of the man so that the devil could not put it out, couldn't quench it. And so I'm thankful for the grace of God in all of these matters. We can be so gullible, can't we, brethren? And I've fallen 1,001 times to those suggestions that hindered me in my progress and left me without joy and left me troubled and turmoiled inside and stolen my peace. We even lose nights of sleep, etc., because of things that we believe from the enemy that we ought not to believe. If we believed better, more truth, we'd be happier people. And so, I just wanted to leave you with that today, that you'd be more aware of these kinds of things. Maybe that's what's going on in your own heart right now, in your own walk. So that we might be aware of hindering persuasions. You were running well who hindered you from obeying the truth. This persuasion is not from Him who called you. Amen. That's all that I have, Brother Tim.